Part 5 Chapter 13 Stepping Out. Home had never felt so strange. Hila's apartment was on the first floor of a house on the edge of Kandahar City, and when she stood by the compound wall in the backyard, she could sometimes hear the laughter of young men as their hashish smoke drifted over. It wasn't long before she avoided that side of the house altogether. But the front wall proved no better. There she could hear men arguing and laughing and spitting onto the sidewalk, and they sounded like police, but she had no way of knowing. It wasn't long before she started avoiding the front wall, too. She tried befriending the widow upstairs, who worked as a cook for an NGO. With the month drawing to a close and rent looming, Hila asked her about finding a job. As it happened, the cook said she knew of the perfect one, working with the director of the Kandahar government's Department of Youth Affairs.
"How much does it pay?" Hila asked.
"Oh, that doesn't matter. He'll help you, I promise," she replied.
"What do I do?"
"This isn't a regular job. Just go whenever he calls you, whenever he needs you, and he'll pay you."
"What do you mean?"
The cook blushed and laughed giddily.
"You'll enjoy the work."
From that moment, Hila avoided her, too. It was early winter 2005. Nearly 3 months had passed since Muskanyar's murder, and in that period, she had been moved 3 times without ever quite fitting in anywhere. First, there had been the American camp in Tirinkot, where she'd been brought by helicopter from Khas Uruzgan. At the camp, she was housed in a small tent and nearly starved herself because she wasn't convinced the food was halal. For days on end, it was only fruits and chocolate delivered by friendly soldiers. She kept herself inside, with her 2 boys, living in a waking dream, never quite sure just what had happened to her. The days were long and quiet, until one afternoon she was brought to an office in town and told to wait in the courtyard. After some time, she noticed the faint, distant chug of a car. It grew louder and stronger, and soon it was right outside. The gate opened. Standing there on crutches, in bandages, was 9-year-old Jamshed, her 2nd child. She ran out and pulled him in tight. They both wept. He asked, "Where is Baba?" She looked him over.
"Father is injured. He's in Kandahar."
"No," answered Jamshed.
"No, I know what happened. There were so many shots."
Hila said nothing.
"Just tell me the truth," he said.
She held him close and sobbed. Some weeks later, she and the boys were moved to Kandahar airfield. The prefab container serving as their home there was the cleanest space she'd ever seen. Too clean, in fact, leaving her little to do but count the daylight hours and think back over choices made and those made for her. Finally, she was brought to Umaid. That a boy of 11 could take 4 bullets and still hold on to life was miraculous. Though that miracle would have been inconceivable without the heroic work of U.S. soldiers and the doctors at KAF. When he saw his mother, Umaid sat up and held her hand, and she spoke to him words of comfort. He was soon transferred to the Kandahar City Hospital, and it was there that Hila had her first stroke of luck. A doctor took pity on the family and gave her about $50 worth of Afghan currency, which she used to find herself a small apartment in the city. It was as far removed from the countryside as you could get. There were no courtyards or standalone guest rooms or gardens out back, just tightly packed mud and cement houses, clotheslines, and electrical wires webbed between them. She could hear a television playing from the apartment of a family upstairs, and she was eager to see it herself, but she did not go up to meet them. The first days had been the hardest. The morning light, the first notes of the muezzin's call, the growing clamor of the street. To Hila, these were rude interruptions of the few hours that still belonged entirely to her, the few hours when her life seemed whole again. She no longer had Muskanyar in the flesh, but he still dutifully visited in dreams, where everything was as it had always been. He spoke to her and walked with her, and they went to all the places they were meant to go, until the night was over, and they started again the next night. It took great effort to manage the tyranny of daylight, and some days she failed. In time, she began to see that each visit of his was a message, a map, charting her life ahead. The immediate challenge was finding work. Without stepping outdoors, this was no easy task. Even though there was no one to restrict her movements, she felt it simply wasn't proper to move about without a marem. She swore to herself that she wouldn't become one of those widows one occasionally heard about, the sort who cavorted with unrelated men and went wherever they pleased. So she relied instead on an acquaintance of Muscagnard's, who came every so often to check on her and bring naan for the family. Once, an aid worker showed up with blankets, two spoons, a bowl, and a mattress. Hila would cut bread into strips and portion them out during the day, and if they grew stale, she would soak them in the bowl with green tea. When Walid woke up crying with hunger, she would rub his belly and rock him back to sleep. By the end of her first month, she was out of options. Some days they survived only on green tea. Some nights, she would think back to her Kabul days and remember the burqa-shrouded widow sitting cross-legged on the sidewalks, children by her side, begging for change. Alone in the world, forgotten, unaccounted for. It was a Friday, the day of mosque-going and shopping. One more day and the landlord would show up. She stood watching the children. Umayd had her eyes, but he had his father's smile. It was impossible to ignore that something within him and the others had altered, maybe forever. She urged Umayd to go out and explore, but he would have none of it. Instead, he spent whole afternoons in a corner, staring off into space. He would not say a word to anyone. The muezzin called for the Friday prayers, and she caught herself counting the hours till sundown. The landlord had said that he would come by first thing in the morning. Hila decided this could not continue. She retrieved her burqa and held it aloft, studying it. She stood thinking a long while about Muscagnard and Khasuragan. Then she fit herself into the burqa, opened the gate, and stepped out into the open city. For the first time in 10 years, she was in the streets without a marem. She wasn't sure what had gotten into her, but she wasn't going to turn back. She headed down the lane onto a broad dirt road. It led her to a crowded neighborhood, and she could hear scooters and auto rickshaws and vendors shouting prices. There were men in patus and swirled turbans standing around pushcarts heaped with vegetables. There was a man in a police uniform, and another on a bicycle, and another selling music CDs. Then she saw the women. There were women begging and women speaking to shopkeepers. They wore powder blue and pistachio green burqas, walking here and there with children and men, or in some cases, by themselves. On their own, she realized. Hila felt as if she had walked into a different country. She returned home, opened up her diary, and began thumbing through the pages in search of names and numbers of Muscagnard's friends. In Khasuragan, it would have been downright scandalous for her to call one of these men, for her to allow them to hear her voice. But she wasn't going to hold herself back, not when there were women out on the streets of Kandahar surviving. It no longer mattered what anyone might think. She found a friend of Muscagnard's in Kandahar City and dialed him. They had a long conversation. A few days later, he showed up at the house and erected a signboard on the outer wall, advertising the services of a midwife. Through this work, she was able to afford another month's rent. Not long after, however, Muscagnard's friend left town and she was alone again. Without his help and cover, she could not operate her midwifery business. But her trip outdoors had awakened something within her, and she scrabbled for more contacts. She knew that she would need to rely on Muscagnard's old circle to survive. One or two kind-hearted souls was all she needed. But none of his friends were in Kandahar. It dawned on her that only one hope remained, only one place in the country where she could go to find them. It was the option she had been avoiding all these months, the option she hadn't even allowed herself to consider, John Muhammad Khan's Uruzgan. The bright noon sun baked the windows. Having finished a prodigious meal, JMK leaned back. A gold-rimmed portrait of Hamid Karzai hung above him. To his left, a photograph of a clock. To his right, of puppies. He spoke to me of his days as Uruzgan's governor in 2005 and 2006.
"Those were good times," he recalled. "We opened up orphanages, built roads, built schools."
Of humble origins himself, He was widely known and appreciated within the Popol Zai tribe for his generosity. He financed weddings and built irrigation ditches, loaned farmers money for seeds, and refurbished the bazaar. One of his passions was female education, so he bankrolled the construction of girls' schools in Tirinkot.
"Wherever women are educated," he told me, "the country is strong."
JMK wasn't the type to sit in an office. He was one of the few provincial governors to accompany American troops on their missions, showing up with his heaving belly and gnarled sandals, walkie-talkie in hand, alongside militiamen who functioned as his Praetorian Guard in private army, with Washington footing the bill.
"We went everywhere, the Americans and me," he recalled. "They were the only ones who truly cared about fighting the terrorists. Sometimes, we even went into the neighboring provinces. Once I headed into Zabul, to the Dai Chopan area, and we went through their villages. The place was full of Taliban."
He laughed.
"We started hanging them from trees. Everyone could see them hanging. After that, there were no more security problems in Dai Chopan."
Once, during a joint Afghan-American mission to a Gilzai region, home to Mullah Manan, they descended on a house where they uncovered weapons, a common enough occurrence in a country awash with arms. In a sequence captured by a documentary filmmaker, a villager was brought out to JMK for interrogation, with U.S. troops and his militiamen seated around him. JMK then began rummaging through photos of young boys and men taken from the captive's house.
"Where did you find these boys?"
"Oh God, what good looks!"
he exclaimed, as his militiamen chuckled. The prisoner sat nearby, uncomfortably.
"Aren't they heavenly creatures? What beautiful boys they are. I wish I was young again. They are more beautiful than 10 women.
After conferring with the militiamen over the evidence, John Muhammad told the prisoner,
"Come on, man. You say this is the photo of a lion? It looks like a donkey."
He glared.
"I'll fuck your mother. I'll make you suck my dick."
Then, through a translator, he sent a message about the captive's fate to an American officer sitting nearby.
"Tell the colonel we'll take him along with us, and for a few nights he will keep us entertained. He will do his thing, and then we'll see."
By 2006, JMK's malign influence had become apparent to everyone. Everyone, that is, except the Americans. UN officials and European diplomats came to view him as a key destabilizing influence in the province, even as U.S. commanders stood by his side, because the very traits that made him so divisive also made him an ideal ally in the war on terror. Still, with the Taliban's resurgence, Washington desperately wanted greater troop contributions in the region from its NATO allies. The Dutch government finally agreed to deploy a contingent to Uruzgan, but only if JMK was removed from office. After much wrangling, President Karzai was forced to comply. He appointed his old friend as special advisor to the president, a sinecure that brought him to Kabul. When I asked JMK about the transfer, he leaned close and said,
"The Dutch actually support the Taliban. I've got all the evidence. It's a well-known fact among certain people. You see, they want to destroy our country so they can fund the Taliban. They and the ISI work together. This is our country's tragedy, the tragedy we suffer through every day. The Dutch are weak, not like the Americans. They don't understand right and wrong. That's why they opposed me. They knew what I'd do to them. Anyone who supports the Taliban is not welcome in my province. That's been my rule from the beginning."
He again praised the Americans as the only foreign nation that truly understood the stakes. The rest, he said, want to bend us over and fuck us. On a spring day in 2005, Hila and the boys pulled up in a taxi to a small house in central Tirinkot. Ajia Hund, an old friend of Muskenyar's, had arranged for her to stay on a property he owned, promising to cover for her if locals discovered that a single woman was living in their presence. It was still JMK's province then, and while he would likely learn of a single female newcomer to town, he did not know about Hila's connection to Muskenyar and the politics of Khas Uruzgan. She planned to keep it that way. Haji Akhund showed Hila to her new lodgings, a squat house with faded butterscotch walls and a single set of windows out front. Mold clung to the eaves, and the outer enclosure was crumbling to ruin. Still, Hila was grateful for what she had. Her compound adjoined Haji Akhund's and was only a few streets from the main bazaar. Everything within a 3-mile radius was government-controlled. Beyond that lay a region that had fallen in part or whole to the Taliban. Khasur Uzgan, 70 miles away, was now insurgent central. As one of Tidin Khat's few educated women, she landed a job through Haji Akhund with Afghan Health and Development Services, a local NGO that offered medical aid to women and children. They paid about $180 a month, more than she'd ever seen at one time. She would get up early to get the boys ready for school, and then she'd be driven to the office in a car with tinted windows. By lunchtime, she'd be back home, ready to receive the boys. Occasionally, the routine was broken, and she was brought to the American base, where she treated Afghan women who were casualties of the war. Hila made sure to go about her work as quietly as possible. The car pulled in only when the coast was clear, and then she scurried out to it in her burqa. She spent the workday in a back room, away from the men, and when she returned home, she did so with equal caution. It took a full year before the neighborhood discovered her presence. She had just returned from work one summer's day and was opening the main gate when she stopped short.
"I saw madness," she recalled.
Beans and sugar were scattered everywhere. Shelves were overturned, clothes spilling out. Her samovar lay smashed. Her sewing machine was missing. Shaking, Hila phoned a translator she knew at the American base, but she could not get through. That evening, she borrowed a Kalashnikov from Haji Akhund and kept it by the bedside. By sunrise, the break-in had already become the talk of the neighborhood, and the secret was out. A woman was living alone and working right in their midst. For some weeks, she stayed away from the office and kept the children home, too. Then one night, as she was drifting off to sleep, she opened her eyes to a noise. She sat up and listened. Something like steps on gravel, or something being dragged across the outside wall. She peered through the window and saw the luminescence of a flashlight from the wall and a man's sandals and his baggy trousered legs and his torso blending into the darkness. She screamed. The children, jolted awake, began shouting. In the clamor, the man stumbled off the wall. She heard him slam into the roof and the pots and pans in her kitchen came crashing down. By the time the first neighbors came running, he was long gone. In the following days, Haji Akhund and other well-wishers advised her to quit working until the dust settled. With money saved up, Hila could afford to lie low for a while, so months went by before she ventured out into the street again. Her first foray outdoors was to the American base to gather donations to distribute to other widows. Later, she started making occasional trips to the NGO office to see her friends. Even with this restricted schedule, though, trouble found her. On an autumn evening in 2007, as she was settling into bed with the boys beside her, she heard a knock on the front gate. She put on her burqa and stepped into the dark night. When she opened the gate, her eyes washed across the street and saw nothing but emptiness. Only as she turned to walk back in did she spot the letter that had been forced under the gate. Neatly written, it said, "Dear Sister, it has come to our attention that you have been working with the occupying and crusading forces who have come to destroy our country and Islam. Please be advised to cease this activity. If you do not, you have no right to complain." It bore the official seal of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, the Taliban. Some weeks later, Hila received a phone call.
"Why are you meeting with foreigners?"
the voice asked. It sounded like a mere boy.
"Who are you? What is this?"
Hila asked.
"I'm telling you, sister. If you keep this up, you will have to accept the consequences."
"Sister." The way he said it unnerved Hila. A boy that young would normally call her auntie.
"I'm only getting medicines," she replied. "I'm giving them out to poor widows. I'm not helping them in any way. I'm just helping our people."
"Then why don't you help us? We need medicine too."
Hila did not know what to say, so she hung up. The calls continued over the coming days, and she began to have violent dreams in which she found herself running from unknown men in the mountains. The dreams ended with her capture and execution, and she would wake up in tears. Ajiahund, who was well-versed in matters of the dream world, explained that it was rare to die in your dreams.
"It's a good thing," he said. "It means you live a long life. This is what people say."
She remembered these words the next time the boy called.
"Stop calling me," she snapped. "Just tell me what you want."
There was silence on the other end, and then he politely said that he'd contact her at the appropriate time. That afternoon, he called back and told her to step outside. She threw on a burqa and opened the front gate. In the blinding white noonday sun, it took her a moment to notice the tall, dark-skinned boy, a patu wrapped around his face, revealing just his eyes. He stared at Hila, and then threw a package in her direction and ran. She opened it to find a new SIM card for her phone and some women's clothing. The boy called again.
"You're a sister to us," he said. "We know what happened to you. Any time you want to call us, use that SIM card."
"There are clothes in here," she said.
"Our gift to you. In return, please send us medicines. We're desperate."
Later that week, she gathered medicines and first aid materials donated by the foreign agencies and the Americans, and left the bundle atop her front gate. She awoke the next morning to find that it had been taken. Over the next weeks, she settled into a routine of collecting aid when she could and leaving it for her new friends. For Hila, the war was not a matter of policy, not a neat delineation of allies and adversaries. It was life itself. Living a war was different from fighting one. It meant keeping yourself somewhere in the gray area of survival. So long as the Taliban left her and her family alone, so long as they dealt with her respectfully, she had nothing against them. These were boys, not much older than Umayd, and given John Muhammad and Commander Zahir and the others on the government side, why wouldn't they fight? The only troubling part was rumors from the countryside that she didn't want to believe, but knew were probably true, like the stories of Taliban stringing alleged spies up on trees and stuffing dollar bills into their mouths. She told herself that her Taliban unit couldn't have been involved. Once a Taliban friend requested that she venture into the field to treat women injured in an American attack. Eager to travel, to see, Hila thought about it long and hard, but in the end she decided not to risk it. And it would be a lasting regret, because one day the calls stopped, just as mysteriously as they'd begun. She waited for weeks, then months, but nothing. Much later, she heard that the Americans had paid an informer to carry a tracking device to the home of the unit leader, and then dispatched an aircraft to finish them all. But it was only a rumor. The moments after the muezzin's call and just before the boys awoke were Hila's most precious. She would write in her diary about the day ahead, about days past, about Muskanyar. She would take apart the night's dreams and Muskanyar's messages to her, as if a proper divination could bring the coming daylight under control. When the boys woke, they would sit down to naan and green tea and talk about school. Shortly after they went off for the day, a car would arrive to take her to the NGO compound. She had started working again part-time, and the neighborhood was, for the moment at least, leaving her alone. At the office, she would sort medical donations into boxes. Occasionally a foreign aid worker would show up, and Hila would receive medicines for cold and fever and menstrual cramps. She would arrange for deliveries to be made to distant parts of the province. Some days, she herself would travel to villages around Tirinkot to distribute chickens and offer women some advice on their care. Everyone would take their nap after lunch. Hila would return home before the boys, and when they arrived, she would send them out to the bazaar to collect groceries for dinner. By the time the family was in bed, the car horns and the vendors' shouts would be replaced by the distant whistle of falling rockets and the faint rapping of machine gun fire. They were the only nighttime sounds Hila knew, and she slept soundly through them. Since JMK's departure, the province had settled a bit. The constant scrapping for territory had ceased, the Taliban holding their ground and the government theirs. The countryside remained a world removed from the streets of Tirinkot, but for the first time in years, people began to feel that things were not deteriorating, even if they were not getting better either. Hila wished that Muskanyar could see her now, making a life for herself in ways no one in Khasuruzgan would have dared imagine. She found herself focusing increasingly on the future, especially on the possibility that one day Omaid might study at university in Kabul, just like his father. She might have continued this way, losing herself in the promise of new beginnings, in the hints of a world slowly writing itself, if not for the events of a spring day in 2008. It began in the morning, when she was at the office and the boys were off from school. Omaid was sitting indoors reading. He had not improved much since the Kandahar days. Due to numerous surgeries, one of his legs was now shorter than the other, and his eyesight was somewhat impaired. A bigger problem was the all-consuming fear he had developed of open spaces, loud noises, unfamiliar streets, and most intensely of all, men with guns. No easy phobia to live with in Uruzgan. By rights, he should have assumed his place as head of the household. Instead, he appeared perpetually sullen. Jamshed had fared better. He harbored no lingering injuries, although he rarely spoke of what had happened that night. He too was at home that afternoon, resting indoors. It was Nawid, Hila's third child, age 8, who was proving to be the strongest of the lot. He'd tell anyone who would listen that someday he would avenge his father. He was also, in Hila's eyes, the best-looking, with butterfly lashes and dimpled cheeks. On that day, he was out by the front gate, playing with the youngest brother, Walid. At some point that afternoon, a car rolled up in front of the house with two men inside. They spoke to Nawid as Walid stood watching. Nawid giggled and the men laughed, and then they opened their door and scooped him up and sat him down beside them. The door closed and the car drove off. Walid played by himself for some time, then returned to the house to relay the events to his brothers. Omaid immediately called his mother. The news hit Hila hard. Walid had recognized the driver as Uncle Ruhola, a cousin of JMK's who sometimes came by the house, a man notorious for his predilection for young boys. She ran to the company driver and begged to be taken home. From there, she called Haji Ahund, but he wasn't answering. She phoned her American contacts, but she couldn't get through. She pleaded with the driver to take her out to JMK's home village, Turi, on the outskirts of Tirinkot, and finally he agreed. As the adobe houses and mud and straw shops sped by, Hila closed her eyes. She thought of Muskanyar, and then thought of John Muhammad, and she felt sick.